Alleluia! Christ is risen! Good morning and welcome again to the celebration of the resurrection at All Souls Episcopal Parish. Welcome to you if this is your 57th Easter in this sacred space. Welcome to you if you were walking by and thought, what the heck, why not? Welcome to you if you struggled to get a little one in a dress or a tie or simply into clothes in order to make it here this morning. Welcome. There is a time-honored tradition in the church that Easter sermons begin with a joke to remind us of the joke that was pulled on the devil when Christ rose alive after 3 days of death. So here goes. There once was a Sunday school teacher who was teaching a class of six-year-olds about the amazing events of Easter. And to test their knowledge of the post-resurrection appearances, she asked the class what Jesus' first words were when he met the disciples after coming back to life. Michael was the first to raise his hand. Was it, "Don't hug me too tight"? Close, said the teacher. That's from John's Gospel. He says to Mary Magdalene, the first one at the tomb, "Do not hold me." Another hand shot up. Yes, Susie. Well, I think that in another story, he says what the angels always do, "Do not be afraid." That's right, Susie. That's in the Gospel of Matthew. Anyone else? It was with hesitation that the teacher called on Billy. But Billy was so sure that he had the right answer, he could hardly sit still. All right, Billy, what was the first thing that Jesus said after he was resurrected? Ta-da! I warned you. Another reason for an Easter joke is to acknowledge the absurdity of why we gather here today to celebrate. Because sometimes in our accumulated layers of Easter tradition, it is difficult to come to the core message that still echoes from that empty tomb of the first Easter morning. And part of our difficulty is in the limitations of language. It is with this in mind that I would like to share a section of David Sedaris' book, Me Talk Pretty One Day. In this section, Sedaris and his partner have moved to France and he is struggling mightily to learn the language. And in one of his French immersion courses, the class is asked to explain what people do on Easter, as there are few better ways to learn a language than to explain your culture. And in this class, there was a Muslim woman from Morocco who had never experienced Easter, and so the teacher of this class asked the assembled students from all over the world to explain this day. The conversation that I will read from is his English translation of their failed attempts in French to describe this great mystery. The teacher called upon the rest of us to explain, "And what does one do on Easter? Would anyone like to tell us?" The Poles led the charge to the best of their ability. "It is," said one, "a party for the little boy of God who call himself Jesus." And, oh, well, here the word would be merde. She faltered, and her fellow countrymen came to her aid. "He call himself Jesus, and then he die one day on 2 morsels of lumber." The rest of the class jumped in offering bits of information that would have given the Pope an aneurysm. He'd die one day, and then he'd go above my head to live with your father. He weared of himself the long hair. And after he die, the first day he come back here for to say hello to the peoples. He nice, the Jesus. He make the good things. And on the Easter, we be sad because somebody make him dead today. Part of the problem, Sedaris writes, had to do with vocabulary. Simple nouns, such as cross and resurrection, were beyond our grasp, let alone such complicated reflexive phrases as, to give of yourself your only begotten son. Faced with the challenge of explaining the cornerstone of Christianity, we did what any self-respecting group of people might do. We talked about food instead. With his trademark humor, David Sedaris manages to offer a startling parable about the difficulty of the layers of language and culture and tradition that obscure this day. Because often when we come to Easter, it is easy to gloss over the road it took to get here, focusing solely on the lilies and the trumpets, the glory and the triumph. But we cannot lose sight of what has brought us to this day. Jesus had been killed. He was dead for 3 days. And to those who loved him, it was tragic, painful, a complete waste of what had been given them. Now, I realize that we cannot but see this through our post-resurrection eyes, so it is critical to experience this through the lens of the women who came to the tomb at early dawn. Mary, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women were coming to do just what they were supposed to do. They were there to prepare a corpse. It was the right thing to do, and this is what one scholar has said about their intent that morning. In the Roman world, providing proper burial was one of the most important obligations of contractual friendship. Throughout the Mediterranean world, it was one of the strongest obligations of family members. That these women, and in John's Gospel, Joseph of Arimathea, undertake the obligation here indicates that they consider themselves members of Jesus' surrogate family. This is what family does for one another. And as Jesus taught, family extends far beyond blood. This is how friends show love for one another. So, truth be told, we too need to share this sense of surprise, of shock, when they found the stone rolled away and two men in dazzling clothes close beside them. Of course they were terrified. The body is gone. The final act of love that they had hoped to offer could not be completed. And yet it is in that moment, in the midst of confusion, that the women at the tomb were asked the question we are to wonder about this morning. Why do you look for the living among the dead? Why do you look for the living among the dead? May our response be as faithful as theirs, because after this question, the women return to the 11 and all the rest with, I can only imagine, a breathless account of what they had seen and experienced. But now, honestly, are we surprised by the response that they receive? How many of us here this morning would have reacted much differently in the midst of grief after having the rug absolutely pulled out from under you? To hear that your teacher, your leader, the one person who has known you more fully than anyone in your life, the one you know to be dead, that he might still be alive? I, for one, feel the disciples' answer, and it is here that the original Greek is most helpful for it. Because in our translation this morning, the disciples respond by saying, the woman's account is an idle tale. In other translations, it is pure nonsense. But that doesn't quite cut it, because the real sense of the Greek word used here is what comes out of the back end of a bull. The dead don't live. It's been 3 days. Won't you just let us grieve in peace? It simply cannot be possible. Or can it? For the last couple of years, for Christmas Eve at All Souls, we have begun a practice of selecting an image to help us wonder about the mystery of the Incarnation. We have done this because rarely can we put into words this amazing mystery that we encounter in the manger. Often it is only through art, musical and visual, that we as finite beings can convey these eternal truths. And this is surely the case when contemplating events like the resurrection. It is for that purpose that the image you have in your bulletin this morning was selected. The image, the disciples Peter and John running to the tomb the morning of the resurrection, by the Swiss painter Eugene Bernan, was created at the end of the 19th century and currently resides at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. In this painting, Bernan interprets the scene from John's Gospel when Peter and the beloved disciple hear the news from Mary Magdalene about the empty tomb and run to see for themselves. Like other of his works, Bernan allows us to enter the story in a very human and moving way. Please take a moment, find this image, and consider this painting. Now, the best way to do this, of course, is with the piece of art itself. It's about 3 feet high and about 4 feet wide. But this morning, we will make do with this miniature version. One of the first aspects to take in is the time of day. It looks to be daybreak. Mary went to the tomb while it was still dark, so as Peter and John hurry to the burial site, it is as if the sky itself is telling the story. The sun is bursting out of the corner, and the clouds are aflame with color. The rush of their haste can be seen in their robes as they stream behind them. Their hands, clasped and held over a heart, seem to tell their own story of anguish. But for me, it is in the eyes of these disciples that this painting conveys what truly only my heart can speak this morning. Because in their eyes, it seems to me, lies the very truth of how we approach the mystery of the resurrection, and it is why I am so drawn to this image. For John, the disciple on the left, has what looks to me to be a look of perplexity, as if what he has been told cannot possibly be true. And yet, There is something that continues to compel him forward. Next to him is Peter, and what I see on Peter's face is simply stunned disbelief. Disbelief that this could be true. How could it be? But could it be? Friends, when we are honest with ourselves, especially on a day like this one, when we gather to proclaim this absurd truth, we often find ourselves in a similar place. And yet, this is exactly why Christians for generation upon generation, century upon century, millennia upon millennia have been gathering to tell this story on this day. Because we believe it to be true. We believe that something happened with those courageous and compassionate women who braved the early morning to come to the tomb. We believe that something transformed those frightened disciples hiding in an upper room so that they witnessed to the ends of the earth, witnessed to a scandalous, absurd truth that led them to their deaths. We believe that in the words of John Chrysostom, hell took a body and discovered God. Hell took earth and encountered heaven. Hell took what it saw and was overcome by what it did not see. And so this morning, the question that remains with me is the same question that confronted the women thousands of years ago. Why do we, you and I, continue to look for the living among the dead? I believe that all of us in this world desire life. And yet often we come to the dark places in our lives and expect death in all its forms and believe that death is the final word. We spend a lot of our lives looking for death among us, don't we? For often, then at least we know what to expect. Truly, few people go to the tomb expecting it to be empty. Rarely do we anticipate resurrection, new life in all of its possibility. And yet, what if death, death of our bodies, death of our relationships with loved ones, death of the hope of meaningful service in this world, death of our very will to live? What if death was not the final word? What then? What if this were true? How would we live? Where in our lives have we been yearning to believe that the pain, the separation, the isolation that we experience in life, that this is not the final answer? Friends, we may not know how, but we do know this to be true. Again from St. John. That Christ is risen and hell is cast down. That Christ is risen and the demons are fallen. That Christ is risen and the angels rejoice. That Christ is risen and life is set free. That Christ is risen and the tomb is emptied of its dead. Why, friends, why do we continue to look for the living among the dead? Alleluia, Christ is risen.